Good afternoon, and welcome to the last of the Evolution in Medicine series. Love to have your feedback on how you have enjoyed or not enjoyed this series. So if you have a chance, come talk to me afterwards and let me know what you think. Today's speaker is especially interesting, and I have to start by saying that if you are ever to find an obvious place to study evolution, you'd have to pick the microbial world. Now, they've been around for millions and millions of years in every conceivable place on Earth, and they've involved the most interesting ways to survive. So unlike mice or birds or humans, you can actually watch microbial evolution happen in the laboratory and in the field, too, although the field is usually your gut or some other extraordinary place. Now, using the power of genomics, scientists can figure out how exactly microbes evolve. And I have to say that there's nothing more awe-inspiring than all of the unexpected ways that evolution solves problems for microbes. You all know, I'm sure, that microbes in general are neither our friends nor our enemies, but there are a few that can sicken and even kill humans. When I was a child, back in the dark ages, we all expected to get childhood infections like mumps and measles, strep, chicken pox, and more. And we all knew children who had polio and tetanus and pneumonia and diphtheria. Ulcers were a common affliction of adults, and most of us, by the time we had graduated from high school, had read and loved Sinclair Lewis's classic book, Aerosmith, about a doctor's fight to stop yellow fever. And we were thrilled when smallpox was finally eradicated as a human disease in 1977. Well, today children are vaccinated for many of those diseases, and others have been driven to extinction. But today there are a new set of diseases to worry about: West Nile, Lyme disease, dengue fever, Ebola. And we all know, most importantly, that most of the world's people suffer from infectious diseases disproportionately. It's the major cause of death in the world worldwide. These are infectious diseases such as malaria, tuberculosis, HIV/AIDS, have been and still are leading causes of death. Over the past decade or so, evolutionary biologists and infectious disease experts have been joining forces to learn how and why new diseases emerge and persist, how infectious diseases become resistant to new drugs, and to learn about the dynamics of diseases in human populations. Now, they're gaining wonderful new knowledge about how evolution works. Scientists in the NIGMS's Evolution of Infectious Diseases program have shown how populations of microbes compete within our bodies and how this competition actually makes it difficult to develop new effective vaccines. They've learned what proteins must evolve and exactly how they evolve in order to allow microbes to move to a new host. And they've learned why the evolution of resistance is a very old and very persistent strategy for survival for both microbes and their hosts. Nobody has been more on the forefront of this area of research than our speaker today. You might wonder about this slide up here, and I'm going to digress just a moment to tell you that this is a Taiwanese bush robin, which I thought was appropriate for our speaker today, Robin Bush. Also, the fact that she studies the flu in Southeast Asia. So Robin came to the study of infectious diseases through an unusual route. In 1977, she received an RN degree and worked for several years as an emergency room nurse, where she gained a real firsthand appreciation for biomedical research. She went back to school and obtained a bachelor's degree from Western Michigan and a PhD in botany from the University of Michigan. On the way, she became an expert in evolutionary biology and statistics, and these skills have really served her well in her research on infectious diseases. Today, she's a very widely known scientist who uses computational techniques to study the evolution of the influenza virus and on chlamydia. Today, she's going to talk to us about how you use phylogenetic analysis of sequence data to inform public health and medicine. Robin? Well, thanks, Irene. My mother actually did name me after the bird. I had to become a biologist. As the last speaker in the Evolution in Medicine series, I thought I would take an opportunity to speak for all evolutionary biologists, whether they want me to or not, who are funded through extramural support through the NIH, for the not only for the financial support that we get, but for the personal support and enthusiasm that the NIH has shown increasingly for our careers. I've been funded for many years through the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and most lately, as of, I guess, February 1st, through NIGMS, through the MIDAS program. I don't know if my guy is around. Models of Infectious Disease Agent Study, which has brought together a number of people who work in different types of computational, mathematical, theoretical approaches they take to the study of infectious disease. Now, to people from my world, which is ecology and evolutionary biology, not too many of us actually work with NIH, and they view NIH as this faceless behemoth that's sort of frightening because it's like this big ATM machine that you don't and you never will get the PIN number for, okay? We send in our proposals and nothing ever much comes back. But I have to say that that has not been my experience, and it's not just because of the money. I've actually found a huge amount of personal support, both for my career and personally. And I think a lot of people in the evolutionary community, biology community, have, partially through Irene Ekstrand, who I've never had any formal association with. We just figured this out by email overnight. I've known her forever, and I actually, she's not only my fairy godmother, but a lot of people's fairy godmother, and as I had the scientific director of MIDAS. And the other one is David Remondini, who probably isn't here, who's from the Center for Scientific Review, and is the SRA for the Genetic Variation and Evolution Study Section. So when people submit evolutionary biology proposals to NIH, this is where they go. And he has also been a stalwart advocate for trying to incorporate evolution into public health. Now, what do I do with all your money? I study the evolution of influenza, and I do it in collaboration with Nancy Cox, who's the chief of the influenza division now at the CDC. They provide data, they provide the brains. Everything I say today that's right about influenza is because Nancy taught me. All the mistakes are my own. Now, I'd like to just stop for a second and talk about some of the other talks. Rudy Raff is the kind of guy that I learned about evolution from, okay? When he was a kid, he's out pulling in fossils and dragging in bugs and critters from outside. And as he became a biologist, he started to realize that the things that he was observing in nature could only be explained by thinking about them in a comparative evolutionary context. That's the kind of background that I come from. Brian Alter spoke. He's a science and education guy. About intelligent design and creationism and the effects that these have in our education system. I am an evolutionary biologist, and I teach evolution. I just got done teaching evolution to a class of 900 freshmen. Okay, not a single one of them asked me whether I thought that we evolved from apes. I'm going to come back to this a little bit later at the end of my talk about the kinds of problems that we have actually in getting students interested in science. Not to mention evolution. I will say that I don't think there's any chance in getting them interested in evolution unless they know some science. I know that for a fact. Our last speaker, Eric Green, who I don't know, gave a wonderful talk. First thing he did was declare he wasn't an evolutionary biologist, and then he went on to give a great evolutionary biology talk. I'm sorry to tell him he is an evolutionary biologist. And what he did, he talked about genome sequencing, and what he's, this is something I pulled out of one of his papers. This is a sequence alignment, and what he's done from it is make a phylogenetic tree, which is a graphical representation to show the relationship in terms of genetic distance between different organisms. And once you've got that tree, then you can start making inferences about why these genes might differ, what effect this might have on the organism, and any kind of particular biological study that you're interested in. And he can come and teach in my department anytime. Now, a lot of people are starting to make phylogenetic trees, and I think that maybe, and I don't know that this is true, but I think maybe one of the reasons that someone would get up and show a phylogenetic tree and say, but I'm not an evolutionary biologist, is because they don't have formal training in using them, and there's a lot of software, and you put in sequences, and out will come a tree. And I got to tell you that a lot of the trees are very difficult to read and to interpret, and a lot of people who are making them could do a better job of presenting them or understanding them. So, for instance, to someone like me, I can look at this and just in a second tell you that these are all exactly the same phylogenetic relationships, that three of these are cladograms, two of them are phylograms, one of them is rooted and the other is not. Okay?
I'm going to go through just, I hope this isn't too pedantic, just a little bit about the basics so that it will help you, because truthfully, even when I see trees, sometimes I look at them and go, where, how are they getting that out of that paper? This is the simplest type of phylogenetic tree, and I'm also, this is not just because I'm being preachy, but it has to do with the rest of my talk when I get to the flu. Here's three taxa, A, B, and C. They have evolved from a common ancestor. You can think of that as being a parent with three children. Now, the fact that the branch lengths, which are genetic distance, that is how many nucleotide changes perhaps have happened since they descended, are about the same for A and B, and it's further till C. That's all it tells you. Try to think of this, I'm really dating myself. Irene thinks she's from the Stone Age. This is macrame, right? Try to think of a phylogenetic tree as being a bunch of strings with a knot, and the knot is the ancestor. And so look at my tree there and think that the only thing that's really stable there is the knot. Well, with the real macrame there, imagine what would happen if you picked it up at one place or picked it up at another. It could be a plant hanger. It could be a bridle for a horse, which is actually what it is. So let's take my tree there and pick it up by the ancestor and let all the branches fall. It's exactly the same, and it takes up less space on the page. A lot of what you see in terms of how phylogenies are represented in publications has to do with how much space they take on the page, which is kind of scary. This is exactly the same relationship. A and B are still, the blue bar and the green bar are the same length, and so is C as they were before. And what we've done here now is go to a rectangular representation, which once again, for putting things on the page, is very useful. And what I've done is put in a black spacer, a vertical bar, which means nothing in terms of genetic distance between anything. It's just to move A and B apart. And you can imagine if I was using a larger font size, that black bar would have to be even bigger. It's that meaningless in terms of anything. I'm going to shut this door. To save even more space on the page, okay, we're talking about column width in papers, and nothing scientific here. You can take the red branch, break it into two pieces, put in another vertical spacer, and flip it around. Okay? That's a pivot point. You can have C up or down. It doesn't make any difference. But it does have a difference to us as humans who are very visual, okay, because I look at that bottom one, and I instantly wonder if C is the ancestor of A and B. And I wouldn't think that if I looked at the one just above it. And it's just because of actually traditions and the way these things are represented. I don't know where my guy is. This is getting troubling. One more thing. Who is the ancestor? Well, here, nobody is. It's that black dot, and it's someone we don't know. Sometimes, to save even more space on the page, you'll see trees printed like this. Or are they putting it that way because they're inferring an ancestor that they maybe don't have any information about? Or did it come out of your computer program looking like that and you don't know why? Or do you see it in someone's paper and it looks like that and you don't know why? Okay. That leads me into the main part of my talk, which is about influenza. And this isn't any hypothetical A, B, or C anymore. This is influenza A, B, and C, the orthomix of viridae. We have influenza A and B, which circulate in human populations every winter, as you know, and C, which is infects humans as well, and is something that you get when you're a kid and isn't as big a deal. We know that A and B are more closely related to each other than they are to C. C is pretty different. We don't know where they came from. All three infect humans. To an evolutionary biologist, we would look at that and say, oh, the source of influenza must be humans. And the fact that that influenza A is also found in pigs, horses, and birds, oh, well, so we're infecting our pets and domestic animals. Probably not the case, as I'm sure most of you have a feeling for. Let's talk about the bug for a second, and then I'll go back to that. So here's the influenza virus, and there's really not much to it for all the trouble it causes. We've got 8 segments. It's a segmented genome with 1 or 2 genes per segment, negative strand RNA. And we get the most evolutionary information from the genes that are most variable, which are these surface proteins, these things that are sticking out of the viral coat, the hemagglutinin, which is involved in receptor binding. It has to stick out. It's looking for your lung cell. And the neuraminidase, which is a receptor-destroying enzyme that the virus needs to get out of the host cell. These things are constantly under attack by our immune system, and they evolve correspondingly. So there's a huge amount of genetic diversity in influenza A. You probably all are just so sick of hearing about flu, but I'm just going to go over it. 16 hemagglutinin alleles, 9 neuraminidases that we know of. There might be more. And I say alleles, what I'm talking about is genetic variants that code for antigenically distinct surface proteins. That is, antibodies against hemagglutinin allele number 1 don't neutralize a virus carrying hemagglutinin allele number 2. And they're pretty different from one another. So we can take our tree and just say, well, within A, if you just want to look at the hemagglutinin gene, come on. We have another subtree. And from each of those endpoints, say H1, H3, some of the human alleles, you could have trees that then showed the evolution within humans within those subtypes. And to blow that up, that's what it looks like in their number, just basically in the order in which they were discovered. Those are the only ones that are known from humans. All of them are known in birds. I could put up a tree for the neuraminidases, for all 9 the neuraminidases, and it would look somewhat similar in that they're all pretty distinct from one another. Only 2 of the 9 are known in humans. So in my own opinion, and this is just my opinion, I feel like there's a whole world out there of influenza viruses that are very variable, that live in birds. And at some point in the long distant past, one of them jumped the species barrier into humans and has evolved along its own little independent evolutionary course and is today what we call influenza C. And that some more recent time in the past, that happened, and that's what we know now is influenza B. And then what is out there in birds today and keeps jumping over into humans is influenza A. And that's my own personal version of it. However, on the data that we've got, there is a question mark up there because we really don't know what happened in the past, and maybe it did fly in on meteor showers, as people used to think. Now, how do these hemagglutins and neuraminidases get in with one another? Because we've got almost every possible combination of hemagglutin alleles with neuraminidase alleles in birds. They're not, as Eric Green talked about with his whole genome studies, marching through evolutionary time together occasionally, you know, losing or gaining a gene. These things reassort, is how we say it, like crazy. Although the extent to which they do, we don't really know, and I'll talk about that at the end, too. So here we've got a situation where you've got a host cell, and it's been infected by 2 different influenza viruses, and we're going to call them the blue one and the yellow one. If they both successfully replicate, out can come a reassortant virus, which in this case has got most of its genes, most of its segments from the blue virus, but it's picked up the genes for hemagglutinin and neuraminidase from the yellow virus. And as a result, you've got a basically blue virus that looks like a yellow virus to a host because of surface proteins. Now, how do you know reassortment has happened? Here's our first tree. The trees are different. This is from a paper by the Australian Flu Group. Actually, I'm going to have tiny little references on the bottom of a lot of papers. A lot of this work I'm showing you today isn't mine. Everybody's doing flu evolution. There's a lot of good work, and I'd be happy to send references or anything to, you know, if you want to get a hold of me later, because they're not readable. Anyway, the hemagglutinin tree on the left, you can see that you've got the big green box, and then the purple and the pink, which are grouped together down below. And I actually superimposed these boxes on here so you could see it. This is a classic case where they could have done a lot better job flipping their nose around and printing their tree on the page, because I had to put the boxes on to figure out what they'd done. Anyway, you can see over on the right, the neuraminidase tree, that the pink clade or family grouping is actually growing out from within the green. Obviously, the viruses within the pink boxes have got their hemagglutinins from one evolutionary lineage and their neuraminidase from another. They're a product of reassortment and the descendants of that reassortment event. So that's one of the ways we use phylogenetics. Now, how much this actually occurs within human influenza viruses, I think probably a lot more than we've known. To tell you the truth, there hasn't been a whole lot of whole genome sequencing until recently, primarily the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase, because they're markers for antigenicity. World Health Organization has used them to track antigenic change over time, and they haven't had the money or the resources really to do whole genome sequencing, and the NIH is now going after that in a very big way. And so I think we're going to be learning a lot more about what goes on. I mean, it happens. We know it happens, and there was a reassortment event in flu B not too long ago that was actually fairly interesting. But that's pretty much it. And, of course, what people really want to know about is, oh, my God, well, what if the yellow one's from a bird and the blue one's from a human? And what if we end up with a virus that's otherwise well-adapted to humans but is unrecognizable by our antibodies? Okay, this is what we would call an antigenic shift event, just flu terminology, when a virus that's antigenically novel switches hosts and starts to circulate in a new population. And it's happened, okay? We don't know where H1N1, Spanish flu, 1918 flu, exactly came from. Jeff Taubenberger's done a lot of great work on that, but to tell you the truth, it's mysterious and it may be lost in the sands of time. However, we do have viruses from the freezer that we've taken out and know that, well, it's interesting, H1N1, you know, started up in 1918 with a bang, and then it circulated until 1957. It evolved to a lower level of virulence. That was our wintertime flu for many, many years. 1957, it reassorted with some sort of waterfall, like a duck, and it picked up H2 allele, N2 allele, and also a polymerase, PB1, which doesn't get put in the name, but I just stuck it in there. H1N1 disappeared. H2N2 circulated until 1968 when it reassorted again with some sort of waterfall, picked up this time an H3 allele, and again, the polymerase 1. Interestingly, again, H2N2 just disappeared when this happened. This is a good point maybe to illustrate in flu, because we have had so few shift events and we have so little knowledge about them, that we tend to take what little information we can get and run with it. It used to be thought that you could only have one strain of influenza A circulating in human populations, because we saw this happen twice, and 2 points makes a line, doesn't it? I'm not kidding. It's really tough. People keep wanting to know. They want to know, you know, what's going to happen, what's going to happen. We don't know. These are random events. We don't have very good records of what happened. I'm waiting to see what happens, if anything. But anyway, we do know one thing. In 1977, a virus got out of a lab. A virus that was identical to viruses, H1N1 viruses from 1950, and started circulating, and it circulates to this day, and you've all been infected with this virus. Okay, so, I guess, well, we can have two strains of influenza A circulating in humans. I think it was last year that they sent out some test kits that had H2N2 in it, and they're like, oh my God, are we going to find out if there's three? But fortunately, that one has not gotten back out. But anyway, so that's the antigenic shift. Now, a couple papers have come out recently where they've gone back and done whole genome sequencing to look at what happened. One comes out of the CDC on the left there, and you can't really see these, but they're very, very interesting paper. That's about these antigenic shift events that I was just telling you about. The one on the right is from the Hong Kong group on H5N1. If you look at the whole genome sequences and you follow over time, you see that it's not like there's one reassortant event, and that virus then spreads. In both these cases, there's some going back and forth with the parental viruses and other reassortment things going on. And what happened in the earlier studies, the ones from the CDC, is that eventually one lineage kind of won out and spread. And that's what we're waiting to see with what will happen with H5N1. You could just as easily, for some reason, get multiple lineages starting to spread in a big way. They might all go extinct. We don't know. I'm going to leave antigenic shift, even though that's what people are most interested in part because that's not what I work on, and although Irene said I work on flu in Southeast Asia, I don't really. I work on human influenza, and I work on antigenic drift, and to tell you the truth, to go along with my mission here of talking about phylogenetics, this is really where we've gotten a lot of inference. I mean, with two shift events, you don't need a tree. Antigenic drift is the evolution of antigenic novelty within a viral lineage within a single host. So here's H3N2, the Hong Kong flu. I've got a lot of sequences. I have made a tree using those rectangular forms, and I've rooted it because we know that it is a reassortant, and it started circulating in humans in 1968. I put the viruses from 1968 down there on the lower left-hand corner. Okay. The horizontal bars, again, are genetic distance, and any vertical distance is imposed just to separate the sequences. One of the first things people notice when they look at this is, oh, my God, evolution must have really sped up there somewhere in the middle. Look at that bend in that tree. Where the circle and the square meet is the mid to late 1980s when they started sequencing in the WHO collaborating labs. At first, they sequenced a little. As time went on, they started sequencing a lot. Well, where do we get sequences from 1968? Of course, they went back in the freezer, pulled them out, and sequenced them. And so we don't have a whole lot. So what you see down in the circled area is a large amount of genetic distance, 20 years worth, with not very many sequences that need to be fit on the page vertically, not taking up much font space. Lots and lots of sequences within the square. To fit them all in there, a lot of vertical spacing was needed. So in fact, your eye can trick you, and it will trick you a lot when you look at these things. Within the circle here is a very large family group. These are viruses that are all descended from a single ancestor. You look at that and you think, oh, that must have caused a nice little epidemic. Actually, this could just be a group that for some reason we have a lot of sequences for. Maybe the Japanese did a study and dumped them all in GenBank, and that they were really completely insignificant epidemiologically. You can't tell from looking at the tree anything really about the epidemiology or the infectiousness of any of these viruses. And the part within the square is just to show that huge areas, pieces of time go by where it's just kind of stepping along. And when you actually map antigenicity, so these are viruses that are antigenically similar to one another, so like would have caused an epidemic per se, you'll see that my little group in the circle, yeah, they're all antigenically similar. That's not such a big surprise. But up in my square, antigenicity changed kind of partway up through that stepping through area. When I show this slide, actually, I had to mess around with my vertical distances somewhat to get my boxes all on there nicely. If I hadn't done that and I took the boxes off and I challenged you to show me where epidemics had occurred, you never could do it. Okay. How did I draw those? Nancy Cox drew those. Okay. From hemagglutination inhibition data. So that's what I do with them. I study the genetics underlying the evolution of antigenic novelty or epidemic strains. So none of the other speakers really went into how simple evolution is. Okay, I mean, this is like, there is nothing to it, and it happens all the time. Replication with error, of course. We all know point mutations, reassortment, recombination. In a single-stranded RNA virus, it makes mistakes all the time. More progeny are produced that can survive in a given environment. Think how many influenza viral particles you sneeze out every time you've got the flu. Of course, they don't all do not go on to infect someone else. If those progeny survive differentially based on their genetics, we say we've had evolution through natural selection. Sometimes some viruses just make it by chance, which we call genetic drift, which has nothing to do with antigenic drift. But in any case, when you have a descendant population who's genetically different from the ancestral population, that's evolution. A lot of people would say, no, that's microevolution, and this is completely different than what happens with the apes or whatever. To me, I study the flu. So let's talk about viral fitness. Genetic variability for a number of traits can influence the fitness of a virus. It has to be able to evade host herd immunity. And in a population like humans who are exposed to flu all the time, our immunity changes on a year-to-year basis. And we are a moving target that virus has got to be after. Although, of course, it's not after anything. It's just mutating away, hoping to get lucky. Host cell binding and entry, got to get in, got to infect, has to replicate within the host. You might have mutations that don't allow it to do that. You have to be able to transmit your progeny to the next generation. So a lot of genetic variability, if it messes up with any of these, is not going to be a successful strategy for a virus. The one we know most about actually has to do with evasion of the host immune system. So here's my tree again. WHO, what they want to do is figure out where is this thing going, because vaccine strain selection at this point in time still has to be made 8-9 months ahead of time so they can get those viruses growing in the eggs. I'm sure you all have heard way too much about the egg problem. The thing is that you've got viruses from the last couple of years still having little lineages here and there. You've got different antigenic types. Typically, they're hanging around somewhere. And constantly, weird new little viruses are showing up down at CDC. Are they going anywhere? Is this next year's epidemic? And so that's what I'm trying to show there with those arrows. You can have from the purple box, let's say, which was last year's epidemic, well, there's still some interesting lineages circulating. Up in the top, which is this year's, well, you've got a couple different lineages going on up there, and plus it's probably just peppered with weird viruses. Which do you pick? Well, one of the things that we did, and this was my first project with Nancy, actually, they'd known from looking at these things for a long, long time, that there's particular amino acid positions in the hemagglutinin, particularly around the receptor binding pocket, that change their amino acid over time. Incredibly variable. And they can be right next to amino acids that never change. And in fact, a lot of these don't change even at the nucleotide level. And they'll be right next to something where the amino acid's just changing. Okay, this virus has to maintain a receptor binding site that can bind to us. Our antibodies are constantly trying to bind around that receptor binding site. So this is a very active area. We had the hypothesis that amino acid positions that have been showing this kind of change in the past were flexible enough to be involved in epitopes that could change rapidly, and perhaps new changes in viruses that we see coming in, viruses that have new changes at these same positions, would be the most likely viruses to cause the next epidemic. That was the hypothesis. So what we did is we went to the tree. I'm up here in the top of the tree, and there's some of my arrows. We picked out viruses that had a lot of, in fact, the most changes at these what we call positively selected positions, positions that seem to be under selection to change a lot, and just found the virus that had undergone the most of them. Right there, it's just kind of sitting in the middle, and nothing about it in particular would cause you to be suspicious. But when you add on the viruses that are collected the next year, you can see it's up there in a brand new lineage, and that, in fact, is where things are going. These others will all die out. Well, we had great hopes, of course, that this was going to be some magic key for vaccine strain selection, on and on, and it turned out not to be the case, although a lot of people hyped it as such, to my embarrassment. I put some boxes on there for you. Let's say that this year is the blue box, next year is the yellow box. And my virus, that red dot, it didn't end up in next year. It would have been a poor vaccine choice. I was right in terms of the general course of evolution, but antigenic drift, it goes along at its own pace, and it has to do with a lot of different factors, have to do with host herd immunity, whether virus is circulating, you know, maybe A takes a break while B circulates. I mean, there's a lot of things that go on here, and this is a very, very simple hypothesis that actually shows some promise, but I think more of what it did was just showed us how little we actually know about the real things that we need to be studying with the flu. So what we've been doing since then is going back and seeing what actually is going on in these transitions between these different antigenic types, because there's genetic variation all over that doesn't cause a new epidemic. And you can take them and pick them apart. You know, these are all the positions that have changed, and some of them involve changes in glycosylation, and some of them are around the receptor binding pocket, and some of them are switching back and forth. Trying to come up with general patterns, not so easy. So what we do is go to the lab. Now with reverse genetics, we can actually take viruses out of the freezer that caused epidemics in the past and amino acid by amino acid change the hemagglutinin into the hemagglutinin of the next epidemic strain. So for instance here, this is a part of the trimer. This is a monomeric hemagglutinin molecule, HA1. Got five antibody binding sites, but pretty much the whole thing is an antibody binding site. And the red part's this receptor binding pocket. In cyan, I've got amino acids that changed between one epidemic strain and the next. And we went through and replaced one, you replaced two, you replaced them all. And we've never published the results of this because it ended up being too simple and too clean. Now, how many people would not publish something too simple and too clean? Take a little pair right up on the side of the receptor binding pocket and tweak them, and all of a sudden, antigenicity changes? I don't know. I think that we probably have a polyclonal response to a number of different epitopes, and what we see epidemiologically doesn't go anything along with what we were seeing here. And so instead, we're starting to look at why we might be seeing this in the lab. Now, Derek Smith from Cambridge and the Dutch flu group have been doing the same sort of thing. Derek's tree has kind of co-opted my colored boxes, but he's got his tree flipped upside down, I think because then he can show his genetic and antigenic maps, which is some very cool representation he's making, so that they actually look like the United Kingdom. Derek's finding the same thing and even some things that are simpler than us. This is a representation where he thinks that only a single amino acid change is responsible, basically, for change in antigenicity that caused another epidemic. Not what we saw when it was happening, it didn't seem. And so I find this whole stuff very curious. And what we've been doing at CDC, and I say we, okay, they do. I sit in my office under my palm trees, right, in California, writing computer programs. They do all the work. The hemagglutination inhibition test is, I'm not going to go into it, but basically this is an antigen antibody test where they're looking, and they've got sera from a ferret up there on the top that they've infected with flu. And they take red blood cells. Here we've got horse cells, turkey cells. They see if it can bind. You've got virus from different panels. You've got different sera. And these tests are not so easy to interpret. In fact, their interpretation, one of the reasons it's difficult is because the virus is evolving, and it's evolving with respect to how it interacts with these other animals. So, for instance, the horse sera, our sera contains what we call nonspecific inhibitors, which will bind to red blood cells just like an antibody in terms of what this test sees. Okay. That's poor little Barbaro up there.
I know.
They used to use chicken red blood cells, and after, I don't know, it was about 10 years ago, they weren't really working anymore, and they had to change and start using turkey cells because the virus had evolved. Remember, these viruses came from birds in the first place. It's not like they don't know a chicken cell when they see it. They had evolved in some manner so that we had to change our diagnostics. Guinea pig cells are used. It's an interesting aspect of evolution that is actually affecting our ability to study it. Here's my tree again. I'm going to just talk about the top part. This is where I think that the field is moving. Now, Irene was trying to say how, you know, I'm a leader and on and on. I will say that I have been very lucky to collaborate with people who have a lot of insight into their organisms, at the CDC in particular. This work was done in collaboration with them and also with an epidemiological modeler named Neil Ferguson from the UK. Neil's been really gotten his hands dirty before with foot and mouth and things like that. And he has the ability with these big computational models that he makes of looking at how host epidemiology and immunity can interact with the virus. So we take his epidemiological models, and these are really just models of evolution that we create using phylogenetics. What does it take actually for a virus to evolve in a certain way and interact with a host in a certain way in its immune system and come up with a long, skinny tree like this? You can use modeling to test hypotheses by giving realistic parameters and then changing them to see what, in fact, would give you the kinds of things that we really see. And you say, well, you know, what do you expect to see? Well, one of the funny things about flu, these circles surround sequences that were collected in particular years. There's some overlap. Some things hang around for years, but the average life of a side branch is about a year and a half. As you move through evolutionary time, the old lineages are going extinct at the same rate in which they're being generated. Okay, so it's mutating like crazy. It's going extinct like crazy, too. So that any particular year, you've got a certain amount of genetic variation in the population, but it's not cumulative. It's not getting bigger and bigger because the old lineages are going extinct. So this is in contrast. Okay, this is the envelope gene from HIV. What we have here are different lineages coming off from original start point and continuing to grow in their own independent manner. You don't see the old ones going extinct. You see more arising. So on the equivalent of the flu tree, it would be like having long side branches coming out of the year 2 circle and the year 3 circle and coming off across the page. We don't see it. We don't know why. The amount of standing genetic variation in the population, a term we use, as you can see, doesn't get any bigger throughout time for flu, whereas for HIV, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. This is, I think, where a real interesting way to approach the evolution of infectious disease. We've done this for flu. I haven't done this for HIV, but this is a direction that people are going in because I really just work with the virus. And in fact, some of the things I say to you might be sort of weird because I actually typically speak from the virus's point of view. Sometimes people just stare at me and go, what is she saying? And they have to say, well, you know, remember, she's on the virus's side. And I'm not on their side, but that's just where I live because that's who I deal with. Combining the epidemiological modeling with the evolutionary modeling is a way to bring it all together because this is the host pathogen interaction. And when we see these different patterns in every different bug you look at will have its own characteristic pattern. I could put chlamydia up. It looks different than either of the two of these. And it's a way, I think, to get a lot more insight and give you new hypotheses to test. So what we did with Neil, these are model simulation outputs of 3 different long, skinny trees, but they differ. So on the left is something like, well, it's hard to say because this is not exactly like my tree because it's fake, but that's meant to represent about what we see. The middle tree doesn't have any side branches at all. The one on the right is more like HIV, and every once in a while pops off some big, long side branch that continues to grow. We set up these models with different types of immune response, and our main finding, I won't go into this too much, is that it looks like of course, we know that we have an antibody response to the flu. So you get the flu, you're not going to be getting that particular strain of flu again. However, having had that strain of flu might also make you immune to other strains of flu for a short period of time, not because of those specific antibodies, but because of some sort of nonspecific immune response. Maybe your cytokines are cranked up or whatever. And it probably is true that if you've just gotten over the flu, and even if somebody coughs in your face, some other flu, you may not get it again. And that's anecdotal, pretty much. In our model, if we did put in some sort of fairly short term, several weeks to a month, very broad, but short-lived immunity, a lot of the mutant lineages that I would perhaps be coughing out at you, if you're all immune, they fall on the floor and die. That's why we're not seeing, to some extent, lots and lots of new antigenic types spreading all over, perhaps. I'm a fan of modeling. I'm a foe of modeling. In a way, you can take this and try to say that you've discovered something new to science, or you can say, hey, maybe the immunologist can go and test this and see if it's maybe more important than we thought it was. And that, I'll just leave that at that. Host cell binding and entry. Interesting. Where does that reassortment take place? It was thought for a long time, and even though I've got it in red down there at the bottom, postulated evolution of recent human pandemics, this was in the textbook of influenza, and it was thought that probably human and avian viruses reassorted in pigs. I've got some commentary published on the phylogenetic trees that were used as a basis to support that, which is actually pretty badly done. We know now from H5N1 that you do not have to have a pig anywhere around for a human to get infected with an avian influenza virus. Now, whether the reassortment will or can take place, we don't know. This is another case in point of us taking 2 points, making a line, taking the ball, and running with it. And it's based on host specificity. Okay, so the hemagglutinin wants to bind to a carbohydrate on the inside of your lung. The carbohydrates on the insides of our lungs, who even knows what they all are? We don't, really. Flu is actually generally an avirulent inhabitant of the avian intestinal tract. We have got these different linkages on the sialic acids. I'm not going to go into it. But it was thought that because pig epithelia had both of them, that that's where these reassortments would take place, that both avian and human flu viruses could infect and reassort in a pig. Well, the truth is, you know, we don't really know what it's going to take, the question of the minute, what it's going to take for H5N1 to jump the species barrier and become transmissible in humans. You know, it's very, very interesting right now. We've got these family clusters down in Sumatra where people are wondering, you know, is the virus changed or is this just a genetically susceptible family? We really don't know what's going on with this. And it's humbling. You know, influenza A has 11 genes. Yeah, you know, you're sequencing all these other genomes. Good luck. We've had this thing sequenced for 20 years. We still get the flu every year. We still don't know what's going on half the time. And we know almost nothing about the genetics of viral transmissibility. I mean, just like nothing. Starting to do some experiments in ferrets. It's really sad. What's really exciting is some work that's mostly coming out of Scripps, where they're taking all sorts of different carbohydrates and putting them on chips, and they're calling them these glycan arrays. And Jeremy Berg did an intro to somebody's talk where he was talking about, as a biochemist, how you realize that actually it's like an evolution of molecules. And here they're showing on the upper right-hand side a bunch of different carbohydrates, tweak, 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 that they've put on these arrays, and then they see what binds. And you can actually take and genetically engineer viruses in the lab, so you think you changed their binding pocket, and see what binds to what. And I personally am very excited about this work. I'm not sure what to think about the results that are coming out. And this is from Yoshi Kawoka's lab in Wisconsin, where he's looking at different parts of the human respiratory tract and seeing what binds where. It's easy to jump to conclusions, okay, just like we did with the pigs. I'm very, very excited about this and don't know where it's going. Ability to replicate in the host. Genetic variation for that, we almost know nothing about it at all. We know that one of the polymerase genes reassorted with the hemagglutinin in both 1957 and 1968. Did it have to? As 2 points making a line again. Tell you the truth, we know almost nothing about variation and replication and how it affects the virus. And then ability to transmit progeny to the next host. Going back to my easy part of evolution, this is almost the end of it, okay? If you can get in, if you can replicate, all you have to do is get your kids out, and if some of them are better than the other at infecting another host and replicating themselves, then you've got evolution taking place. Well, of course, we make more viruses than we can possibly spread. They dry up, they fall on the ground. A lot of them are non-viable. They have deleterious mutation. They don't have all their segments or whatever. Some are transmitted to non-susceptible hosts. Some are transmitted to immune hosts. This is Irene Extrand, who swears she's never had the flu, and I would like to check your serology. Okay, a lot of people, it's subclinical. She swears she's never had it. Very few viruses are both viable and successfully transmitted to a susceptible host, yet we all get the flu all the time, don't we? As an evolutionary biologist, I look at this and say, wow, was that good luck on the part of that virus, or was it good genes? You have to do experiments to find out, and it's been a really difficult thing because we can't do experiments, the kind of experiments some people might want to do on humans. Looking at it from the point of view of the virus, bad luck or bad genetics? Okay? Is the woman lucky or is it the virus? There's two sides to every story, and there's no intention on either side. We're mutating. We had different kind of lung epithelia. They're mutating. Their binding pocket's changing, and it's just this dance that's going on. I'm real interested in this dance, and as an ecologist and evolutionary biologist by training, what about these poor birds? You know, they have gotten almost no attention whatsoever. There have been people who occasionally, you know, look at some bird viruses, and they have, you know, say, oh, they hardly, you know, do anything. Who cares about them or whatever? All of a sudden, people have gotten very interested in bird viruses, and there's a huge amount of activity that's just getting underway because everyone's afraid that the bird flu is coming, right? So I'm sure all of you instantly really realize that this is a mixed flock of four different species of wading birds, right? Okay. These guys have gotten the most attention. They're out there. They're all dabbling in the water. They're all crapping in the water, and the next duck is drinking it up. Most of the attention has gone on, has been paid to these guys. And there are programs going on now all over where they're looking at flyways. If you want to look at it real simplistically, oh, yes, they're going to come from Siberia to Alaska, and then they're going to go down that red part and come get me. People who actually study birds, well, this is a little bit more realistic, where actually these quarters aren't quite cartoon-like. My friend Tom Smith, who I haven't seen in a million years, and then I don't know if Irene, who invited him to the last Midas meeting, some of my old buddies from ecology and evolution world, I'm actually getting to see now again because we care about what they do. This is the migration of the Swainson's thrush, winter and summer breeding grounds, showing the different populations that aren't that distant from another at one part of the year can go to very, very different other places during the winter. Tom's actually going to be looking at passerines. Nobody's paid almost hardly any attention to whether or not these little perching birds carry the flu. There's reports that they do. We don't really know much about it. So there's a lot of different groups who unfortunately aren't working together as closely as I would like them to see, starting to look at this. Now, most of you guys know Canada geese, right? And you know what they do. They crap all over the place, right? They do. I would never go in the water when they're around. I wouldn't even want to walk when they're around. And this is this vision that we have of waterfowl transmitting influenza. I look at this and I think, what is in that water? How many strains of flu are in there? Are these birds bringing it up and transmitting it differentially? Really, what is the ecology? What's going on there? Because we can't see this virus. So people are going to be going out and sampling the birds. Ever since the Midas meeting, Irene doesn't know this, I have been on the phone just getting after people, say, get the water too. Because the ducks only get what is given to them. And in terms of the ecology of this system and its impact on us, it'd be nice to know really what's out there. We only see what comes out the other end of the duck's butt. Now, getting back to the theme about Brian Altern's talk, my students don't come to me, okay, and ask me about evolution, about human evolution and apes and stuff. Most people don't know where University of California is, okay? We're in Orange County, and these aren't my students, but these could be my students. Some of them may be my students. I don't know. I've not had one of them come to my office. Now, you think they're sitting there talking about whether intelligent design is really creationism? Apparently, some of them are, but I'll tell you what they really are very interested in is evolution, and they're interested in the evolution of bird flu. Because although we do have some of that stuff going on, when I teach my class on evolution and infectious disease, this is really what my student population looks like. Look at them. Okay? This is one of these transportation maps that the Midas type people are using to map the global transportation networks. Here's the center of the universe as we know it, Los Angeles. And when my students go home for Christmas, okay? And where their relatives are, they are scared to death about bird flu. They are scared for themselves. They're scared for their families. Before bird flu, they were scared about SARS. I've had kids in my office crying, okay, about this stuff. They are intensely interested in the evolution of influenza. And I think it's a real hook to get them interested in science. They don't care if there's any monkeys around here. They're very, very interested in this. I could teach an entire class on this and get, just like I had 900 in intro bio, I could get 900 of them to come and study this. And it's a way to engage them actually in science that makes an impact on their life and teaches them that evolution isn't something that just happens in some weird book with, you know, whatever on the cover. So I think that evolution is important to public health, obviously, and not too many people are really denying that any longer. I think that ecology is going to become increasingly more important. Our interaction with birds, our birds' interaction with the environment. These are some rocks off the coast of California, completely covered with guano. And here are students of the future who now are, hey, little junior evolutionary biologists, even though at home they might not want to admit it, and that maybe next time it'll be an ecology and evolution of medicine conference. Thank you. Be happy to take questions. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, right, yeah, yeah. I know. Yeah. I love his books. Yeah. In fact, I have to restrain myself. Yeah. Very, very beautifully done. I truly think that a lot of this information that people are putting out could be much more effectively portrayed, especially to non-scientists. Yeah. Nobody else? Yeah, you've all probably had it with flu. Aren't you sick of it? I'm sick of it. I am so sick of it. I just wish it would go away. Nope. Okay, thank you.